me around a corner and down yet another icy hall. "Where are they taking him?" I demanded, and received another example of the pale woman's guard's idea of gentleness as a gauntleted fist doubled me over. I could almost take a full breath again when they paused at one of the icy doors. One of the guards produced a long tool and thrust it into a small opening in the ice. He jigged it until I heard a catch give, and then pulled the door open with it. They threw me inside, and I landed face down on some patchy deerskins on the floor. One followed me, and I rolled, trying to escape the punishment sure to come. But he only caught at my bound wrists, pulled them up high and screamingly tight, and then suddenly released them. The knife he had used to cut the bindings nicked my hand in passing. He was not concerned.
"Don't make noise," he warned me. "She doesn't like it, and I don't like having to come and make you be quiet."
The icy door closed behind him before I could think of a reply. The earlier blow to my head had left me woozy. I lifted my head just enough to be sure I was alone in the chamber. As soon as I was reassured that no forged ones lurked there, I let my head drop, closed my eyes, and tried to think. I opened them again. A minute, a day, a week had passed. The light in the chamber remained the same. I had had no useful thoughts, and perhaps I had slept. I got up slowly, feeling various aches. They were washed from my awareness by the tide of anxiety I felt for the fool. Where had they taken him, and what was his fate? It suddenly seemed incomprehensible to me that we had not struggled harder to keep from being separated. My cell was quickly explored. The bed was a wooden box of straw with several blankets over it. A bucket in the corner for waste. Another bucket held water, skimmed over with ice. A rag by it suggested that perhaps it was for washing. The deer hides on the floor. I patted my clothes. My guards must have taken the dragon tools whilst I was unconscious. I had no weapons, not even the fool's little knife. No windows except the low slit in the unyielding door. A light globe stuck to the ceiling, far out of my reach. No food. No way to measure the passage of time. I moved from the floor to the bed, such as it was. I considered Night Eye's old advice, when sleep is the only comfort you can take, take it. It will leave you better prepared for whatever might come next. I closed my eyes and tried to sleep. It didn't work. I tried to skill. Nothing. I quested out with my wit. I could vaguely sense other humans nearby, but the prevailing presence was that of the dragon. And then ice fire was gone again. I sat up and leaned the bruised back of my head against the icy wall of my chamber. It eased the throbbing. I must have dozed, for I woke with my hair frosted to the wall. I pulled free slowly, groaning irritably at myself. I had explored the slit in the door and the crack that outlined the edges of the door several times when the guard came back. I was sitting on the floor, peering out of my cell. I wondered if I should be flattered that she sent three guards for me. They were different men from the ones that had captured us. "Lie face down on the floor," one of them ordered me through the door slit. I obeyed. Fighting three men would not improve my physical condition. I heard them come in, and one of them matter-of-factly dropped a knee into my back to hold me still while he roped my wrists behind me again. They used the rope and my hair to haul me to my feet. They were a practiced team, with no need to speak as they marched me out of my cell and down the corridor. "Where is my companion? The tawny man that was with me?" A punch to my left side, just below my ribs, answered me. They marched on, dragging me until I got my feet under me again. We passed no one else, and I realized that I had lost my bearings. The icy corridors were all too much the same. Even if I had been released that instant, I would not have known where to begin searching for either the fool or a way out. For now, my only option seemed to be to go with them. Then we came to an arched portal of ice with doors of polished wood. One of my guards knocked. A woman's voice bade them bring me in. The doors opened and we entered the pale woman's bedchamber. The white orbs that gave off light were placed oddly, on the floor and on a low table, illuminating only the centre of the room. An iron brazier burned smokelessly, adding a slight note of warmth. The rest of the chamber softened off into shadow. I glimpsed a large bed crouching at the edge of the light, and a row of servants standing silently waiting to be summoned. I could not tell how large the chamber was. The pale woman had just emerged from a tub of steaming water. The tub itself seemed to be made of very thick glass. The water within it was a cloudy white, and the fragrance of summer flowers rose with its steam. She stood, naked on a lush white bearskin, calmly regarding us as two dispassionate maids patted and rubbed her dry. She seemed to feel no discomfort at baring herself to our gaze. She was an even white all over, a woman of snow or marble. Her white hair was painted flat to her skull, with water that dripped off the pointed tips of her tresses. The faintest hint of rose showed in the standing nipples on her globular breasts. The tuft of hair at her loins was as white as that on her head. Like the fool, she was long-limbed and limber-waisted, but lush of hip and breast. No man could have looked at her and not felt a stirring of lust. She knew that. Yet she showed herself to us, captive and guards alike, as if her ability to flaunt her body and yet remain safe from undesired attentions emphasized her power over us all. Her stony-faced guards made no reaction to seeing their mistress thus. They stood, one on each side of me, and one behind me, and waited. Her handmaidens brought her soft fur boots and draped her in a robe of fine silk, followed by a second, heavier pelisse of wool trimmed with white fur. She took her time seating herself in a low-backed throne of dark wood. A third Out-Islander woman entered, and I recognized her suddenly as Henja. She carried a fresh towel and brushes and pins. She moved behind the pale woman and began to dress her damp hair for her. And all this while, the lady had not spoken a word. She leaned back in the chair and gave herself over to Henja's attentions with evident pleasure, for her eyes closed to narrow slits as Henja's ivory brush moved slowly through her white mane. When her long hair had been combed out and then braided in a multitude of long plaits and pinned to her head, she opened her eyes and looked about the room. She gazed at me as if noticing for the first time and gave a small frown.
"He is unwashed. Did not I tell you to provide wash water for him before you brought him to me?"
The guards cowered, and one said hastily,
"We did, my lady. He ignored it."
I am not pleased. These simple words to my guards made them pale. She shifted her gaze to me.
"You reek like kibbal raw bread. I had thought six duchies' men were cleaner."
Her eyes flicked toward the tub.
"Remedy it now. There is water in the tub."
She lounged back in her throne, challenging me.
"Wash, Fitz Chivalry, you will dine with me, and I desire to smell the food, not you."
I did not move, nor allow my expression to change. She smiled lazily.
"Do you fear to lose your dignity by undressing and washing? I assure you, most of my servants do not remember what human dignity means, let alone care for yours. You cling to your stench as if it were your pride. I promise you this, you will lose far more than your dignity if you must be forced to bathe. Choose swiftly. I am not patient, and I will not smell such a smell at my table."
In an aside to her servants, she observed,
"You would think that a king's son, even a bastard, would have more pride in himself."
"My hands are bound," I pointed out stiffly. My mind searched for escape, for advantage in the situation, and found none. Her words had made me aware that I did stink. I felt a moment of shame, and then recognized her tactic. Chade had long ago explained the usefulness of breaking a man's pride and self-worth before interrogating him. For some men it was more effective than torture. Take a man's dignity, imprison him like a beast, and when you offer him back the small comforts of civilization, his gratitude is often disproportionate. Sometimes a man can be won over simply by a small display of kindness. Kept in a cold cell in the dark with no food, a man will perceive a candle and a hot bowl of soup as an offer of amnesty. It is far less work to break a man that way than with torture. She smiled at me.
"Ah, yes. Bound hands would make your task more difficult."
She gestured to the guard.
"Take him to the tub and cut him free."
I was propelled to the tub in a way that left no doubt that they would force me to do anything she desired. Refusing would give the guards further excuse to beat me. Complying might yield me some advantage, if only that of having my hands free. I gritted my teeth and surrendered my dignity. Once my hands were free, I turned my back to her and stripped. I managed to palm my fox pin from inside my shirt as I did so. I entered the water. I washed quickly, refusing to let the warm water offer me too much comfort. One of her women brought me soft soap in a bowl. Somehow I found myself gravely thanking her. She made no reply. The water was grey when I stood up from it. Two women advanced on me with towels. I took both towels and turned away from them to dry myself. A moment later they were back, offering soft shoes of felted wool and a clean white wool robe. My weary buck garb had vanished. I put on what they offered, concealing my pin inside the collar of the robe as I did so, and turned back to my audience. The pale woman had had her chair turned so that she could watch me. She smiled a cat's smile now, and observed, "You have some interesting scars, and the body of a warrior. Shave him, Henja. I would see the full face of the man who was almost a king." It shocked me to hear such words. I had never thought of myself that way. For a moment the title almost seemed true. Then I rejected it as another tactic of hers. The two women were back, bearing a chair, and Henja appeared with a bowl, soap, and shaving blade. "I'll do it myself," I said hastily. The idea of that woman flourishing a knife near my throat was unbearable.
"That you will not,"
the pale woman informed me, smiling faintly.
"I do not underestimate you, Fitzchivalry. I know what you were trained to be. Your family made you a killer, not a prince. They never let you see what they cheated you out of. But I will. I will show you the rightful heritage they stole from you. Yet until I know that you perceive all that I offer you, no weapon will I put in your hand. Sit still now. Henja is a skilled body servant, but I shall not hold her responsible if you twitch."
I do not think I have ever been more uncomfortable in my life. While Henja shaved my face and then combed back my damp hair, the other women inspected my hands, cleaned my nails, and trimmed them. And all the while the pale woman watched me like a cat watches a bird. No one had ever administered to me in such a way before, yet I found this luxury humiliating rather than comforting. I opened my mouth once to ask, "Where is the fool?" Henja's blade immediately nicked me. I felt the trickle of blood start from the side of my cheek. Henja placed a towel firmly against the cut to staunch it while the pale woman replied,
"I do believe we are looking at him, are we not?"
At that point, I could scarcely argue with her evaluation. Her guards chuckled dutifully, but a glance from her restored their composure. As her maids fussed over me and her guards stood and stared coldly, other servants brought in a table. They set it with a white cloth and heavy silver implements and dishes. They placed a candelabrum upon it and lit the 6 tall white candles. Then they brought in covered plates and tureens. Steams and rich odours of food escaped to taunt me. Wine and glasses were brought as well, and finally 2 cushioned chairs were set at either end of the table. Henja wiped my face and stepped aside to bow to her mistress. The pale woman came closer to me, but remained out of arm's reach. She cocked her head and studied me coldly, from head to foot, as if I were a horse she was considering buying.
"You are not ill-made," she offered me. "Before your family allowed you to be abused, you might have been handsome. Well, shall we dine?"
She walked to her chair, which one of her guards drew out for her. I rose and followed her to the table, aware that one of her guards shadowed me. A wave of her hand indicated that I should seat myself opposite her. Once I was seated, she waved again. The guard at my back retreated to the shadowed depths of the room. At her command, the pale globes in the room suddenly dimmed. Only the candlelight remained, isolating us in an island of yellow light. It gave a false air of intimacy to the setting, yet I knew that her guards and maids lingered unseen in the dimness, watching us from outside the circle of the candlelight. The table was small. She ladled soup into a bowl and placed it before me, before serving herself from the same tureen.
"So you don't think I will poison or drug you?"
she explained as she took up her spoon.
"Eat, Fitz Chivalry. You will find it very good. And I know you must be hungry. I shall not trouble you with talk just yet."
Nonetheless, I waited until I had seen her take two mouthfuls before I picked up my own spoon. It was very good, a rich and creamy white soup with bobbing chunks of root vegetables and tender meat. It was the best thing I had tasted since I'd left Buckkeep, and I would have wolfed it down if my manners had not stayed me. My self-control seemed to be the only shield I had left, and so I forced myself to eat slowly, to take bread from the basket she offered and butter from the plate. She poured white wine for us, and when the soup was gone, offered me slices of tender pale fowl from a platter. It was delicious, and the food comforted my body despite my desire to stay on guard against her. There was a white pudding for dessert, redolent of vanilla and speckled with warm spices. We spooned it away, and all the while she watched me, silent and speculative. The wine hummed in my blood, relaxing me. I struggled against it, then recognized what I was feeling. I took a deep breath and relaxed into it. Now was not the time to struggle. She smiled. Had she sensed that surrender? I became more aware of her. She was wearing a perfume, a scent like narcissus. When we had finished, we stood. A wave of her hand notified the unseen servants. As they emerged from the shadow to clear the table away, the fire in the brazier blazed up as a man set fresh fuel on it. A cushioned couch, curved in a half-circle, had been placed to face it. The pale woman walked to it and seated herself, patting the pillows beside her. I followed her and sank down into its comfort. Her kindness was disarming my wariness. Food and wine had filled me and taken my edges away. She would try to get information from me with innocent questions. I kept my thoughts small. My task would be to remain on my guard and to get as much information from her as I could, while giving her as little as possible. She smiled at me, and I feared that she sensed my ploy. But then she curled her legs under her, just as the fool would have, and leaned toward me. Her round knees pointed at me. "Do I remind you of him?" she asked suddenly. It seemed pointless to dissemble. "Yes, you do. Where is he?"
"In a safe place." "You are very fond of him, aren't you? You love him," she replied for me before I could answer. "Of course you do. He has that effect on people when he chooses to use it. He is so intriguing, so charming. Do not you feel flattered that he offers you even the chance to know him? He dances at the edges of your understanding, offering you tiny hints of who he truly is, like feeding bits of sugar to a dog. With each little bit he offers you, you feel valued that he trusts you so. And all the while, he extracts from you every bit of knowledge that he needs, plunges you into danger and pain for his own ends, and takes from you everything you have to offer. He is my dearest friend. I would like to see him and know he is well treated." My words sounded stiff. My heart sank. Her description of the fool was cruelly accurate. It demoralized me, and I saw that she knew it. "I am sure you would. Perhaps later, after we have talked. Tell me, do you believe he is truly the White Prophet, come to set the world in a better course?"
I lifted one shoulder. I had never come to a firm answer on that. Yet I felt disloyal to the fool as I said, "So he has always told me."
"Ah, but he could just as easily tell you that he was the lost king of the Island of Tales. Would you believe that also?"
"I've never had reason to doubt him." I tried to speak stoutly, but felt the doubt she sent me creeping into my heart.
"Haven't you? I see. Well, I shall have to give you some, then."
She reached down, and from an unseen vessel on the floor took a handful of something. She tossed it onto the flames, and a sweet scent rose as it burned. I leaned away from it, and she laughed.
"Do you fear I'll try to intoxicate you? I do not need to. Your own logic and common sense will convince you. So, Our friend has told you he is the white prophet. Even though he is undeniably no longer white. Surely he has told you that true white prophets remain white all through their long lives. No? Well, then, I do tell you that now. We are descended, as he may or may not have told you, from the true whites of legends. They were a wonderful folk, long vanished from this and all other worlds, pale as milk and wise beyond telling, for they were prescient. Now anyone with two thoughts in their mind can see that no future is set in stone. An infinite number of futures barred at the end of every moment, and each one of them can be changed by a falling rose petal. Even so, some are more likely than others, and a few so likely that they are like fierce channels for time to thunder through. In ancient days, before your people's telling, we saw this, we whites, and began to see also that by our actions we could influence which of those futures would come to be. We could not guarantee them, of course, but we could use what we knew to set other lesser folk onto paths that would gradually divert the flow of time into quieter, safer waters, where all could prosper. Do you understand what I'm telling you, Fitzchivalry?
I nodded slowly. Despite her words, the fragrant smoke from the brazier was inclining me toward her. I was aware of her scented skin and of her fine white hair, so sleekly braided. Awareness of her body was slipping into my skin like spring sap moving into buds. I sighed, and she smiled. She seemed to have come closer without moving.
Yes, that is right. Consider how you came here. Walking into my stronghold, delivering yourselves into my hands. I knew that one day I would possess both of you. And yet the devices by which you came into my power were unclear. And so I set out to sway the future by setting into motion every device that might bring you to me, or make an end of you. My agents traded with Rigol. Oh, yes. To be sure that some tools that might have been useful to you were sent out of your reach. Many that were forged were given a purpose as well, to find you, or Verity, and kill you. All of them failed, but still I labored on. I sent Henja to Buckkeep, and we bribed the piebalds to capture you both and deliver you. Yet they failed. Again I cast my nets, sending you a cake with delven bark in it to quench your magic. But only you partook of it, and that sent my plan awry. I captured the men Chade sent for supplies, knowing well you must come after them. But before I could take you, you vanished from my knowing, only to walk right into my power. That is the power of the flow of time, Fitzchivalry. It was almost inevitable that you would come to me. I could have trusted to luck to bring you here, but it is the right way to try to assure the future we wish to see. And even when we knew our race was vanishing from the world, we tried to reach forward in time to assure that we would not lose all our influence. You see, the prescience of the whites warned them that they would one day perish, and that the world would have to blunder on without them. But one among them, a woman, with truer vision even than the rest of her race, knew that their influence could go on. If she would willingly mingle her blood with that of an ordinary mortal. And so she did. She roamed the world, and whenever she found a worthy hero, she bore him a child. 6 sons and 6 daughters did she bear, and each looked as human as could be. But when she went on from the world, she was well satisfied, for she knew that whenever the descendants of her children met and mingled in love-making, a white child would be born. Their wisdom and gifts of prophecy would not be lost to the world. Isn't that a lovely tale?
The fool said that only one white prophet is born at a time.
The fool! Oh, that is such a charming love name for him.
She smiled, her pale lips arching like an ivory bow.
And so apt. I'm surprised that he lets you call him that.
She gave a little sigh.
I suppose I should be pleased that he was that honest with you, yes. Only one white prophet can reign.
And for this age, that one is, of course, me.
He is a freak of breeding, a throwback born out of his time. I suppose that is why he is darkening. Had he been kept at the temple until he darkened, he could have done no harm. But his keepers were always too soft with him, too trusting of such a charming little fellow. And so he wriggled away from them and went off into the world, working his mischief. Let us see if we can undo a little of it. You and I. Tell me, what is the terrible fate that he so fears for the world, that he must pit his paltry influence against mine?
I was silent for a time, then admitted, I don't exactly know. A time of darkness and evil. She made a pleased sound, like a settling cat.
Well, I shall speak more plainly to you than he has. He fears an age of man, when the strongest shall rule and bring the wildness and disorder of the earth under their dominion. Why he sees that as an evil, I have never understood. For me, it is my goal. Let us have order and productivity. Let us see the strong beget strong children to come after them. If I succeed, I shall see that power is balanced in the world. My poor out-islanders lack all good things. They have stony soil to till in their weak and chilly summers and wring their living from the unforgiving sea. Despite this, they have grown to be strong people, deserving of better things. I came to try to help them. You cannot deny that would be a great good for the world. But your tawny friend thinks he has finer ideas. He thinks, among other silly things, that he must restore dragons to the world, that the dominion of humanity must be checked by competition. Has he told you that?
He has spoken somewhat of it.
Has he? That surprises me. What great good did he say would come of restoring an immense predator that regards the entire world as its hunting ground? A predator that respects no boundary, concedes no ownership, and regards humanity as, at best, useful, and more often, as a food source. Tell me, do you relish the idea of your people becoming cattle for great-scaled beasts?
Not particularly. It was the only possible answer to such a question. But again I felt traitorous. Her careful words were sending streamers of uncertainty unfurling through me. She laughed, delighted with my response, and settled herself more closely to me.
Of course not. None of us do. I may be a white, but my parents were human.
I struggled a little. But you set the out-islanders on my people to raid us in their red ships. They burned and despoiled and forged my people. That was not good.
And you think I incited them to that? Oh, what a twisted view. I held them back, dear friend. I restrained them, and did not allow them to claim the lands they had conquered.
You have seen Kebal Rawbread.
Does he look like a man who carried out his dreams of conquest and plunder?
Of course not.
Who put him where he is?
I did.
How can you look at that and think, I am the enemy of your people?
I did not have an answer to that. I turned from her to stare at the brazier. I felt again the tickle of my skill magic, and heard, or thought I heard, thick, distant music. I told myself I imagined it, for the skill was dead in me. I felt the touch of her cool hand on my cheek, and she turned me back to meet her eyes. I considered the white column of her throat, how soft it would be beneath my touch. She held my eyes, speaking,
"Your fool did not lie to you when he said the white prophets come to divert history from its set course. I've done my best. I could not completely change the course of events, but I tried. The red ships raided your coast, but they did not claim your lands."
She spoke simply and reasonably. I felt her words close around me like a net.
"When traitors within your own land sold Kibble's merchants books of your magic, I could not prevent him from learning it and attempting to turn it against your folk. But some of the blame for that must fall on your own people. They sold the skill scrolls, did they not? And why? Because a younger son of undeniably royal lines desired more power for himself. I know you did not like Regal. He did not care for you. Some part of him recognized how unlikely a creature you were, how rare the occurrence of your birth in all the braided lines of time that might be. Almost instinctively, he tried to do away with you, so that time might flow in its allotted channel. Think of this. Regal traded secretly with the Out-Islanders. Had he come to power, that trade would have been more open. The Out-Islanders would have been welcomed to your shores in trade, not war, for the mutual enrichment of all. Would that have been so terrible? It might have come to be, were it not for the machinations of your fool. I will be honest with you. Such peace and prosperity would have demanded that your life spark wink out early. But can you honestly say that the price would have been too high? Time and time again, you have been willing to lay down your life for your family. Was not Regal, your family, as much a farseer as you? If you had died but once, swiftly and mercifully, for him, would that not have been an honorable sacrifice?
She had taken my view of the world, and my family, and the six duchies, and twisted it into an unrecognizable form. The silky thread of her telling wrapped around me inexorably, becoming a new truth that bound me. I groped after all I had known but a moment before, and found a flaw in her logic. If I had not been born, my father would have reigned. She laughed lightly, but her smile was gentle.
"You quibble, and you know it. Your father would have died. Childless, in a hunting accident while he was still a young man. Over and over, I have seen it happen in my visions. Verity would never have wed, and would have perished from a fever the next winter. If you had died at the right moment, then, in time, the throne would have passed smoothly to Regal. He would have had his father's favor and guidance, and he would have become a great ruler. Yes, the line would have ended with him, but it would have ended splendidly, in peace and plenty, for the six duchies as well as the Out-Islands. I have no reason to lie to you about any of this. It is far too late for that future to be, so what could motivate me to lie to you?
I did not know. And yet I did. My skill again fluttered at the edges of my awareness. It was a flighty, untrustworthy magic. I knew that. I had always known that. I felt her assure me of it. Pay no mind to it.
You're deliberately confusing me. You contradict yourself and twist my knowledge of truth. You're mocking me.
She laughed, throaty and delighted.
Of course I am. Just as your beloved fool does. And you love it when he dances his words all around you, offering you 100 ways to see the world. And so shall I delight you now that you are mine. For I am taking you. I must. We must work together to put the world back in its true course. Not by your death this time, but by the life I shall give you. You will be my catalyst now. A catalyst 1,000 times more powerful than Kibble Rawbread. And I shall delight you 1,000 times more than your pitiful fool did. for we are, at last, the perfect fit for one another. We shall be not just prophet and catalyst, but male and female, making the whole that turns the world. I will be to you everything that he secretly longed to be with you, and could not, except that I will be perfect, as he was flawed. You will come to see that you are not betraying him, but being true to the world and all that was meant to be. Taste the sweetness of the world as it was meant to be. Taste. Her face had come ever closer to mine as she spoke, and then her mouth touched mine. Her lips were all softness, her tongue a teasing coolness that bade my lips part. And she spoke true. A giddy sweetness, wilder than anything I had ever known, spread through me at her cool touch. I shivered as I put my hands on her shoulders, holding her mouth against mine. Lust flooded me, and the rightness, the inevitability of the moment, pushed aside all other thoughts. I cared not that her guards and maids watched us from outside the circle of candlelight. I cared for nothing except the gleaming white perfection of her body. Only one thing was still lacking in the future she offered me. I let my thoughts stray to it. "Our child will be beautiful," she assured me, as she released me and stood up. "You will delight in our son. I promise you this." I could feel the truth of her words, and they went thrilling through me, like ice and silver in my blood. A child. She would give me a child whom I could hold and cherish. A child who would never be taken from me. She knew all that I most desired, and offered it all to me. She created in my thoughts the future that I had always most longed for, tailored to my every need. How? Why could I resist that? She stood and lifted her robe over her head, and let it drop to the floor beside the couch. The silken shift followed it. She stood before me, letting the yellow light of the brazier play over her body. Golden light touched her whiteness, gilding the curves of her body and face. Her white breasts were round and heavy. She lifted them to show me, weighing them in her hands, inviting me to taste them. Slowly she sank down beside me, and then leaned back, opening her arms and her thighs to me. "Come to me. I know everything that you have ever wanted, and I will give it all to you." She lolled her head back against the arm of the couch. Her colourless eyes looked through me and beyond me. The truth of her words thundered through me with my pounding blood. I stood and fumbled my garments out of the way. She dropped her eyes to see what I would offer her. And in that instant, I slammed up my skill walls tighter than ever I had before, blocking her insidious tendrils of influence. I flung myself on her, as she had expected, but my hands closed on that milky throat as I brought my knee down sharply onto her gently rounded belly. I felt her skill batter at me along with her fists. I knew well I had one chance to make good my grip on her, and I knew the icy instant when I had missed it. I should have known that just as she mirrored the fool in appearance, so also she possessed his uncanny strength. She had no need of her guard as she tucked her chin down tight to thwart my strangle. Her clasped hands came up between my elbows, and then she flung her arms wide, breaking my grip on her throat. She flung me backwards off her, and as I fell against the brazier, sending it and hot coals flying in every direction, she lifted her hands. The white globes of light blazed suddenly, flooding the room with illumination. Guards surged at me from all directions, a flood of armed men. It was inevitable that they would take me down, and I would have been wise to let them, to offer them my sudden surrender. Yet my glimpse of the fool, gagged and spread like a trophy hide on one icy wall, roused me in an anger I had not felt since the days when I had battled Red Ship raiders with an axe. The tumbled brazier burned my hands as I seized it and flung it at my attackers. I fought them, expecting them to kill me, and thus holding back nothing.
I think that is why it took them so long to subdue me. They were more restrained than I was and rendered less damage to me than I did to several of them. I know I broke one man's collarbone, for I heard it crack, and I recall that I spat out a piece of ear. But, as with all battles when such a mood is on me, my recollection is disjointed and vague. I recall clearly that I lost the struggle. I knew it was over when I was down on my belly with three men kneeling on me. There was blood in my mouth, some of it my own. I have never scrupled against using my teeth in a brawl, not since I first bonded with the wolf. My left arm no longer obeyed me. As they hauled me to my feet, that arm flopped and flailed against my side, wrenched out of its socket, I thought sickly, and waited for that pain to find me. I had almost made it to the fool's feet. I lifted my eyes to look at him. He was pinned to the icy wall like a butterfly, his arms spread wide, and even his head held against it with a metal band around his throat. The gag was tight enough to cut his mouth. Blood had leaked in a line from the corner of his mouth to drip down his shirt. They must have ransacked his pack, for he wore the rooster crown, the wooden circlet jammed down on his head to the top of his ears. His eyes were open, and I knew he had witnessed all that the pale woman had staged for his torment, that that had been the whole point of her attempted seduction of me. I knew, too, as our eyes met, that he understood that I had never betrayed him. I saw the feeble twitch of the skilled tips of his fingers on one pinioned hand. He, too, had sensed her subtle attack on me through my reviving skill sense. "I tried!" I cried out to him, as his head bowed as much as his binding would allow it, and his eyes began to sag shut. The guards had had their sport with him. Patches of blood seeped through his clothing and streaked his sweaty hair. Now he was held immobile and silenced against the ice, tormented with the cold he had always so hated. Had he foreseen this slow and icy end for himself? Was that why he had always so dreaded the cold? "Bring them both to my throne room!" The pale woman's voice was like ice cracking. I swung my head to look at her. She had retrieved her garments and donned them. Her lower lip was beginning to swell, and several loosened plaits dangled by her face. Such were the fruits of my deadly attack upon her. Yet I felt small amusement as my guards seized me roughly, careless that one of my arms hung limp and useless. The piteous cries of the fool followed me, as they tore him from his bindings. The halls seemed longer and whiter than they had been, as if the lights burned brighter with the anger of the woman who strode ahead of us. We encountered few people, but all we passed cowered or shrank to the side of the corridor as she swept by them. I tried to make note of how we went and what turns we made, telling myself that if the fool and I escaped, we must know in which direction to run. It was useless. Both the effort to memorize the way and the effort to fan hope in myself. It was finished. We were finished. And that was the end of it. The fool was going to die, and I would die alongside him. And all he had worked for would come to a bloody and useless end. Just as if I had died the very first time that Regal looked at me and proposed to Verity that I meet a discreet end. I did not know I had spoken aloud until one of the guards gave me a rough shake at the same time he bade me, "Shut your hole!" On we went. It was hard to focus, and harder still to overcome my fear, but I lowered the walls I had raised against the skill. I gathered my small strength and tried to skill out to Dutiful, to warn them and to beg for help. I was like a man patting his clothes, trying to find a misplaced pouch. My magic was gone again, and I could not muster it. Even that last weapon was lost to me. The pale woman had already resumed her throne by the time we entered the hall. A few of her retainers lined the walls. They watched dispassionately as the fool and I were dragged before them. There we were halted and pushed to our knees as before. For a long time she looked down on us in silence. Then she gestured at the fool with her narrow chin. "Give that one to the dragon. He can have Theldo's place. Let the other one watch." "No!" I cried before a fist to my ear sent me sprawling on the ice. The fool made not a sound as they dragged him forward. When they were close to one of the chained captives, the guard matter-of-factly drew his blade and plunged it into the wretch. The man did not die swiftly, but neither did he make much noise or fuss about it. I think most of him had already gone into the dragon, and there was little left of his spirit to mourn his body's passing. He fell against the dragon as he died, and slid down the creature's stony flank. For a few moments his blood was a vivid red smear down the stone. Then, as sand takes in water, the blood was sucked away from the surface, leaving the scales in that area more clearly defined than they had been. Two guards moved efficiently, careful not to touch the dragonstone as they unshackled the hapless wretch. One glanced at their queen, and at a nod from her, he cut and disjointed one of the man's arms from his shoulder as neatly as if he were preparing a fowl for the pot. He did not look as he tossed it in Kebel Rawbread's direction. I wished I had not. The mad king lunged the length of his chain, seizing the flopping bloody arm, and fell upon it as hungrily as a dog on a joint of fresh meat. He was a noisy eater. I turned aside, sickened. But a worse sight awaited me. My guards tightened their grips on me, and a third man stepped up to seize my head by my warrior's tail and grip me tight. The fool's guards moved forward with him. He did not resist. His face looked like that of a man near bled to death, as if he could no longer feel horror or pain, only the encroachment of death. They shackled him, ankle and wrist, to the dragon. By standing in a half-crouch, knees and elbows held out, the fool could avoid contact with the thirsty stone. It was a posture that was a torment in itself, and one that no man could hold for long. Sooner or later he must tire, and when he did he must fall against the dragon and yield something of himself to it. The fool faced a slow death by forging.
"No,"
I breathed, as the reality seeped into me. And then,
"No!"
I roared at the pale woman. I twisted my head to look up at her, heedless of the hair torn from my head.
"Anything," I promised her, "anything you want from me, if you let him go."
She leaned back on her furs.
"How tedious. You capitulate much too easy, Fitzchivalry Farseer. You didn't even wait to witness the demonstration. Well, I shall not deny myself that pleasure. Dret, introduce him to my dragon."
The named guard stepped forward, drawing his sword.
"No!"
I roared, twisting helplessly against my guards as Dret set the point of his blade to the small of the fool's back and urged him against the stone dragon. He held him there only for an instant. The fool did not scream. Perhaps it did not cause pain to his body. But as the man took back his sword, the fool recoiled from the stone as a hand does from a hot ember. He leaned against the brief length of his chains, trembling, but soundless. On the dragon's skin I saw for an instant the outline of my friend's body as the dragon drank in his memories and emotions. Then his silhouette faded into the stone. I wondered what the fool had lost in that brief kiss of stone. A summer's day from his childhood? A moment of watching King Shrewd and Chade talking by the firelight of the hearth in the old king's room? Had it been some moment he and I had shared, now snatched from him and gone forever? He would know such things had happened, but forging would erase their significance to him. Our friendship, and all we had meant to one another, slowly would be erased from his mind before he died. When he died, he would not even have memories of having been loved to ease his passage. I lifted my eyes to the pale woman. I think she drank in my misery as the dragon had sucked down the fool's stolen moments. "What do you want of me?" I asked her. "What?" She spoke calmly.
"Only that you take the easiest path and play the most likely role in the days to come. It will not be difficult for you, Fitzchivalry.
In almost every future I have foreseen, you accede to my request. Do your prince's bidding, do Chade's bidding, do the Narcheskas' bidding, and mine. Take Icefire's head. That is all. Think of the good you will do. Chade will be pleased, and your queen will win her alliance with the Out-Islands. You'll be a hero in their eyes. Dutiful and the Narcheska can consummate their love for one another. I ask nothing difficult of you, only that you do what so many of your friends hope you will do.
Don't kill Icefire,
the fool's low-voiced cry begged me. The pale woman sighed, as exasperated as if interrupted by an ill-mannered child.
Dret, he wishes to kiss the dragon again. Assist him.
Please, I shouted, as the man again slowly drew his sword. I pulled my head free of my captor's grip to bow it in subservience before her. Please don't. I'll kill Icefire. I will.
Of course you will,
she agreed sweetly, as the tip of the sword sank into the fool's back. He resisted, even as fresh blood soaked his shirt.
Fitz, she has the Narcheska's mother and sister captive here. We saw them, Fitz. They are forged. Eliania and Piotr do her will to buy their deaths.
And then the fool screamed wordlessly as he surrendered to the sword's bite and sagged against the dragon. He twitched all over, and the press of the guardsman's blade seemed to hold him there for an eternity. I would have covered my eyes if my hands had been free. I did shut my eyes tightly against the unbearable sight. When the scream ceased and I opened my eyes, my friend's body was outlined in silver on the dragon. More precious than blood, the experiences that made him who he was seeped away into the soulless stone. The fool stood, muscles taut, straining against his chains to avoid contact with the stone. I heard the gasp of his breath, and prayed he would not speak again. But he did.
She showed them to me, to show me what she could do to me. You can't save me, Fitz, but don't make it all for nothing. Don't do her again,
she said, between weariness and amusement at his stubbornness. Again Dret stepped forward, again the sword, again the slow, relentless push. I bowed my head as my friend screamed. If I could have died at that moment, I would have done so. It would have been easier than listening to his torture, far easier than the terrible, soulless relief that it was not me. When the echoes of his cries had faded, I did not look up. I could not bear to. I would say nothing more to her or to the fool, nothing that might tempt him to speak and bring more punishment on himself. I watched the drops of sweat that dripped from my face fall onto the ice and vanish, just as the fool was vanishing into the dragon.
Beloved,
I tried to skill the thought to him, to send him something of my strength, but it was a futile effort. My erratic magic, poisoned by elf bark, was gone again.
I think I've convinced you,
the pale woman observed sweetly.
But I'll make it very clear. You choose now Icefire's life or your beloved's. I'll set you free to be on your way to kill the dragon. Do my will and I give your friend back to you, or as much as is left of him. The more swiftly you go, the more of him there will be for you to reclaim. Delay, and he may be forged completely, but not dead. I promised you that. Not dead. Do you understand me, Fitz Chivalry Farseer, little assassin king?
I nodded, not lifting my eyes to her. I got a fist in the short ribs for that, and managed to lift my head. Yes, I said softly. I understand. I feared to look at the fool.
Excellent,
Satisfaction burned in her voice. She lifted her eyes to the ceiling of her glassy chamber and smiled. She spoke aloud.
There, Icefire. He understands. He will deliver you to your death.
She looked back at my guards.
Turn him out from the north chimney. Let him go there.
Then, as if she could feel my confusion, she met my eyes and smiled kindly.
I do not know how you find your people again. I only know that you do, and that you kill the dragon. All is so clear before me now. There is no other path. Go, Fitzchivalry. Do my will, and buy your beloved back. Go.
I called no word of farewell to the fool as they marched me from the room. I feared he would somehow acknowledge my departure and earn another kiss from her stone dragon. They took me through the icy labyrinth of her lair at a quick march, and up an endless flight of stairs that eventually emerged into a sort of ice cave, a space between the rock and the glacier. Two held me, kneeling, as the third cleared the ice-blown snow and frost that blocked the entry. Then they stood me up and cast me out.
Chapter 22 Reunion.
That our king-in-waiting Chivalry is not at all the son whom King Shrewd supposed him to be. As you can well imagine, this has grieved my good husband beyond telling. But, as ever, Prince Regal has done all in his power to be a comfort to his beloved father. It was my sad duty to inform both my lord and our wayward prince that, in light of his besprinkling the countryside with bastards, for where there is one, can we doubt there are others, my dukes of the inland duchies have expressed doubt as to Chivalry's worthiness to follow his father as king. In light of that, Chivalry has been persuaded to step aside. I have been less successful in persuading my lord that the presence of this by-blow at Buckkeep Castle is an affront to myself and every true married woman. He maintains that if the child is restricted to the stable and the stableman's care, it should not concern the rest of us that this physical evidence of Lord Chivalry's failing is ever flaunted before us. I have begged in vain for a more permanent solution. Letter from Queen Desire to Lady Peony of Tilth.
We had emerged from a crevice that overlooked a steep slope. My guardians laughed. Before I could deduce the reason, I flew through cold darkness, then hit frozen snow. I broke through the crust, found my balance, and rolled to my feet. Darkness surrounded me, and when I took a step, I stumbled, fell, slid, regained my feet, fell and slid some more. I was clad only in the wool robe and felted shoes the pale woman had given me. It was small protection. Snow found me and clung to me, melting on my sweaty face and then cooling swiftly. My left arm was a thing that flopped and flailed against me. I finally found my footing and looked up and back whence I had come. Clouds obscured the night sky and the usual wind was blowing. I could not see any sign of an entry to the pale woman's realm. I knew that the blowing snow would very soon obscure all trace of my tracks. I did not go back now. I'd never find it again. If I went back there now, what good could I do? My left arm hung useless, and I had no weapons at all. But a stone dragon was slowly devouring the fool. I stood and staggered up the hill, trying to find my own trail where I had slid. The slope became too steep. I felt I was treading in place, making no uphill progress, and all the while getting colder. I swung wide of my trodden trail and tried again to force my way up through the snow. The wool of the robe grew heavy with clinging snow and was no protection at all to my bared legs. I lost my balance, and holding my injured arm tight to my chest, fell and rolled downhill. For a time, I just lay there, panting. Then, as I struggled to my feet, I saw a tiny yellow light in the veil below me. I stood and stared at it, trying to resolve what it was. It bobbed with the rhythm of a man walking. It was a lantern, and someone was carrying it. It could be one of the pale woman's people.
What worse could they do to me than what had been done? It might be someone from our camp. It might be a total stranger. I lifted my voice and shouted through the wind. The lantern halted. I shouted again and again, and suddenly the lantern began moving again, toward me. I breathed a prayer, addressed to any god who would help, and began a staggering slide down the hill. With every step I took, I slid three, and soon I was running, trying to leap through the snow to avoid sprawling face down in it. The lantern had halted at the bottom of the slope. But when I was almost close enough to make out the shape of the man holding it, the lantern resumed its bobbing motion. He was walking away, and leaving me. I shouted, but he did not pause. A terrible sob welled up in me. I couldn't go on any further by myself, and yet I must. My teeth were chattering, my whole body aching as the cold stiffened the bruises from my beating, and he was leaving me there. I staggered after him. I shouted twice more, but the lantern didn't pause. I tried to hurry, but I could not seem to get any closer to it. I reached the place where the light-bearer had briefly paused, and after that I followed his broken trail through the snow, finding the going a bit easier. I don't know how long I walked. The dark, the cold, and the pain in my shoulder made it seem an endless trudge through night and wind. My feet hurt, and then grew numb. My calves were scalded with the cold. I followed him across the face of a hill and along a ridge, down into a dip, ploughing through deeper snow, and then began a long, slow climb across another slope. I could not feel my feet and did not know if my flimsy shoes were still on them or not. The robe slapped against me as I walked, whipping my calves with its frosty burden of clinging snow. And with every step I took, I knew the fool was still shackled to the dragon, hunching wearily away from the stone that would, at a touch, plunder him of his humanity. Then, miraculously, the swinging of the lantern stopped. Whoever my guide was, he was now awaiting me at the top of the ridge we had gradually ascended. I shouted again from my raw throat and redoubled my efforts. Closer I drew, and closer, bowing my head against a wind which was angrier along the ridgetop. Then, as I again lifted my eyes to mark my progress, I saw clearly who held the lantern and awaited me. It was the black man. A nameless dread filled me. And yet, having followed him that far, what else was I to do but go on? I came closer, close enough that when he lifted the lantern, I could briefly make out the aquiline features inside his black hood. Then he set the lantern down by his feet and waited. I clutched my arm to my chest and staggered uphill doggedly. The light grew brighter, but I could no longer see the black man standing beside it. When I reached the lantern, I found it resting upon an outcrop of rock that protruded through the shallower snow on the wind-swept ridge. The black man was gone. I used my right arm to lower my left hand to my side as gently as I could. My shoulder screamed when my left arm dangled its full weight, but I gritted my teeth and ignored it. I picked up the lantern and held it aloft and shouted. I saw nothing of the black man, only blowing snow. I trudged on, following his trail. It ended in a wind-scoured ridge of rock. But in the next valley, not far below me, I saw the dimly lit tents of our camp, and I immediately abandoned all thoughts of the black man. Below were friends, warmth, and possible rescue for the fool. I staggered through the snow towards the tents, calling out Chade's name. At my second shout, Longwick roared a challenge up at me.
"It's me! It's Fitz! No, I mean, it's Tom! It's me!"
I doubt that he deciphered anything I said. I was hoarse from shouting and competing with the wind. I well recall my deep relief when I saw the other men stumbling from their tents and lanterns being kindled and held aloft. I staggered and slid down the hill toward them as they fanned out to meet me. I recognized Chade's silhouette and then the prince's. There was no squat thick amongst them, and I felt a sob build in my chest. Then I was finally within hearing of the line of men, breathlessly calling,
"It's me! It's Tom! Let me through! Let me in. I'm so cold. Where is Thick? Did you find Thick?
From their midst a broad-shouldered man stepped forth, past Longwick, who tried vainly to motion him back. He ran three strides toward me, and I took a deep, unbelieving breath of his scent just before he enfolded me in a bear hug. Despite the pain to my shoulder, I didn't struggle. I dropped my head on his shoulder and let him support me, feeling safer than I had in years. Suddenly, it seemed as if everything would be all right. As if everything could be mended. Heart of the Pack was here. And he had never let us come to harm. Over my bent head, Burrick spoke to Chade angrily.
Just look at him. I always knew I should never have trusted him to you. Never!
In the chaos that had erupted, I stood still on my icy feet, ignoring the shouted questions around me. Burrick spoke by my ear. Easy, lad. I'm here to take you home, both of you. You and my Swift. You should have come home years ago.
What were you thinking? Whatever were you thinking? I have to kill the dragon, I told him. As soon as possible. If I kill the dragon, she'll let the fool live. I have to cut off Icefire's head, Burrick. I must.
If you must, then you will, he said comfortingly. But not right this moment. Then to Swift.
Stop gawking, boy. Fetch dry clothes and make food and hot tea for him, quickly.
I gratefully surrendered myself to the steady hands I had always trusted. He steered me through the cluster of staring men to the prince's tent, where my heart nearly broke with relief at the sight of Thick sitting up sleepily on his pallet. He looked none the worse for wear, and even seemed glad to see me, until he was told he'd have to move his bed for the night to make room for me. He went off with Longwick in charge of him, but not graciously. Thick had skilled to Chade and the prince as soon as we'd vanished in the crevice, and Chade had immediately sent Longwick and Cockle to fetch him back. He'd spent a miserable night sitting on the sled in the cold, with only his skill contact to sustain him. When his rescuers had reached him the next day, they'd found no sign of Lord Golden and me except for the sunken snow that had filled the crevasse. I sat down, dazed with cold and exhaustion, on Chade's bedding. Burrick spoke to me as he built up the little fire in the pot. His deep voice and the rhythm of his speech was a familiar comfort from my childhood. For a time I heard his voice without paying attention to the words, and then I realized he was reporting to me just as I had once reported to him. Once he had decided he must fetch Swift and me home, he had come as swiftly as he could, and he was sorry, so sorry that he had taken so long to find us. The Queen herself had helped him hire a boat to Azlevial, but no man of the crew would willingly set foot on the island. When he had landed, he had tried to persuade Chade's guards to guide him to us, but they had righteously refused to leave their tent on the beach and the supplies they guarded. And so he had come on by himself, following Piotr's pennanted poles. He had reached Thick's sled at almost the same time as Cockle and Longwick. Only their shouts of warning had prevented him from plunging into the same abyss that had claimed the fool and me. Once he had found a safe crossing point, he had come back to the camp with Cockle and Longwick, bearing the news of the loss of Tom Badgerlock and Lord Golden. Chade had brought him to the privacy of the prince's tent, and quietly told him that those names also belonged to the fool and me. Burrick had journeyed all the way to Azlevial only to hear yet again of my death. His voice was impassive as he related this to me, as if his own pain at hearing such words were of no consequence. I am glad to see that they were wrong. Again. His hands were busy chafing my hands and feet back to painful life. Thank you, I said quietly when I could flex my hands again. There was too much to say to Burrick and no privacy to say it in. So I looked at Chade and asked my most burning question. How close are we to killing the dragon? Chade came to sit beside me on his bed. We are closer than when you vanished, but not close enough, he said bitterly. We were divided when you left. Now it's worse. We've been betrayed, Fitz, by a man we had all come to trust. Webb sent his gull to Bingtown, bearing a message that tells the traders everything, and bids them send Tintaglia to keep us from killing Icefire. I shifted my gaze to Dutiful and stared in disbelief. You let him do this? Dutiful sat on the end of his pallet, his dark eyes large in his face as he watched us. There were new lines in my prince's face, and his eyes were swollen, as if he had wept freely in recent days. I scarce could bear to look at him.
He did not ask my permission,
Dutiful said painfully.
He said no man needs permission to do what is right.
He sighed.
Indeed, much has happened in the few days you were gone. In your absence we continued to dig down to the ice. We reached a point where we could see a huge shadowy body below us. Realizing we had dug down to the torso of the creature, we began to tunnel out from the side of our pit, following the line of his back toward his head. It has been cramped work, but less difficult than excavating the entire area. We believe that what we can see below us now is the dragon's neck and part of his head. But the closer we came to him, the stronger grew the feeling of the Witcoterie that this is a creature which is not ours for the killing. That he harbors both life and intellect, although none of us can reliably sense him. My old bloods still dig alongside us each day, but I fear that they will side with the Hetgerd if I attempt to kill Icefire.
He looked away from me, as if shamed that his trust had been betrayed.
Tonight, just before you came into camp, Webb admitted to me that he had sent Risk.
The contention was hot, he said quietly. My hope for a swift end to the dragon waned. It required every bit of discipline I had ever been taught to recount my misadventure in detail and in order. Irrational shame burned me as I spoke of how I had walked away from Hest and Riddle. When I told them of the fool's fate and of his words about the Narcheska's mother and sister, Dutiful swayed where he sat.
At last, it all comes clear. Too late.
I knew he was right, and despair claimed me anew. Even if I knew the way back, even if I could persuade them to muster our entire force and march on the Pale Woman's stronghold, we were too few. She could kill or forge him in moments, and doubtless would. Nor could I hope to kill the dragon quickly and win his release. Clear the ice, and we must still get past the Hetgerd, our own old bloods, and perhaps Tintaglia. The Pale Woman's promise that he would not die was a thinly disguised threat. The fool would be forged. To me would fall the task of taking what remained of his life. I could not contemplate it.
If we went by stealth to the pit, could we kill Icefire? In secret, tonight?
It was the only plan I could think of.
Impossible, the prince said. His face and his voice were grey. The ice between him and us is too thick. There are days of pick and shovel work ahead of us before we reach his flesh. And before then, I fear Tintaglia will be here.
He closed his eyes for a moment.
My quest has failed. I put my trust in the wrong place.
I looked at Chade. How much time do we have?
How much time does the fool have?
He shook his head. How fast can a gull fly? How swiftly will the Bingtown traders react to Webb's message? How fast can a dragon fly? No one knows those things, but I think the prince is right. We have lost. I gritted my teeth.
There is more than one way to move ice, I said, and looked at Chade meaningfully.
The old man's eyes lit. But before he could reply, Swift's voice was lifted outside the tent.
"Sir, I've brought Tom Badgerlock's pack, and food will follow. May I come in?"
Dutiful nodded at Burrick, and he moved to beckon his son inside. The boy came in. His bow to his prince was stiffly formal, and he did not look at his father or me. It pained me to see how the division between the prince and his Witcoterie tore the boy. At Burrick's command, Swift dug through my pack to pull out dry clothing for me. The lad did not seem well disposed towards his father, but he obeyed him. Burrick saw me observing them, and after the boy had left, he said quietly,
"Swift was not exactly glad to see me when I got here. I didn't give him the thrashing he merited, but he's had the length of my tongue several times. He's not said much in reply,
for he knew he deserved it. Here, take off that wet robe. As I struggled to pull up my leggings, Burrick suddenly leaned into the light, peering at me with his clouded eyes. What's the matter with you? What's wrong with your arm?
It's pulled out of the socket. I choked out. My throat had closed up at the sight of his eyes. I wondered how much he could see any more. How had he come to find us here walking with clouded eyes across the snow? He closed his eyes and shook his head. Then,
"Come here," he said tersely.
He turned me and sat me down on the floor at his feet. His fingers walked my shoulder, and the pain they woke was oddly reassuring. He knew what he was doing. I knew it would hurt, but that he would also mend me. I could sense that from his fingers, just as I had when I was a boy, just as I had felt when he restored me after Galen had nearly killed me.
"We've brought the food. May we come in?"
The voice outside the tent was Webb's. The prince nodded curtly, his mouth a flat line, and again Burrick lifted the door flap. As Webb entered, he greeted me with, "It's good to see you alive, Tom Badgerlock." I nodded gravely, not trusting myself to find words. He met my eyes and accepted my hostility. The prince looked aside from the man, his hurt plain in every line of his body. Chade glowered at him. Webb's expression remained as kindly and calm as ever. The small kettle he carried smelled like good beef rather than the fish I'd been expecting. Swift was behind him with a pot of tea. They crowded into the tent and set their burdens down within my reach. Burrick continued to investigate my shoulder as if they were not there. He ignored Webb, but the Whitmaster watched Burrick intently. When Burrick spoke, it was to Dutiful.
"Prince Dutiful, my lord, you could be of great help to me right now if you would. I'll need someone to hold him firmly round the chest and brace him while I do what must be done. If you would sit there and lock your arms around him, higher, like so."
The prince came to Burrick's request and sat behind me. When Burrick had arranged the prince's grip around me to his liking, he spoke to me.
"This is going to take a sharp tug. Don't look at me while I do it. Look straight ahead and be as loose as you can. Don't tighten in fear for the pain to come, or I'll only have to jerk it harder the second time. Steady? Hold him firm, my lord. Trust me now, lad. Trust me."
As he spoke calmingly, he'd been slowly lifting my arm. I listened to his words, letting them drown out the pain, his touch filling me with calm and trust.
Be easy, and now!" I roared with the sudden shock,
and in the next instant Burrick was on his knee on the floor beside me, his big, calloused hands holding my arm firmly to my shoulder. It tingled and it hurt, but it hurt the right way, and I leaned against him, weak with the relief of it. Even as I panted, I noticed how he held his game leg out at an angle, the knee scarce bending. I thought of what it had cost him to come all this way, near blind and half lame, and I felt humbled. He spoke quietly into my ear as he embraced me.
"You're a man grown, all these many years, but when I see you hurt, I swear. You are 8 years old, and I'm thinking, I promised his father I'd look after his son. I promised."
"You did," I assured him. "You have." Webb spoke quietly, his voice deep.
"I stand amazed. That is a bit of old blood magic I thought was lost to us. I saw that kind of healing done on animals a few times when I was a lad, before old Bendry died in the Red Ship War. But I've never seen it used that way on a man, nor so smoothly. Who taught you? Where have you been?